I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
So, John, do we want to get going?
I think so. It's a little, now. You want to give it like two more minutes? Just give people to get it? I have 103 right now. Do you want to give it two more? Because this is an hour and 15 minutes, which is longer than we normally run anyway.
So
we still have time.
So?
And should we leave the door open or should we shut the door?
We will shut them.
Okay.
And restart.
Okay.
I don't know. This just doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right.
What's that?
There's people here.
Do you want to just get going then?
I was wondering if you could all leave. We're used to doing this in a vacuum. There's like no one here.
Just turn our backs.
Could work.
Yeah.
But I'm also used to, normally we do this in the super secret underground lair of the functional nerds. So there's, you know, the sun isn't blocked on this side. I'm surrounded by nerdy things.
You're still surrounded by nerdy things.
Yes, exactly. But not all those things. There's not enough. So let me break out my nerdy thing. There you go, poosers.
Excellent.
We have Cap.
These are the things that Patrick puts in for, because as some of you may or may not know, Patrick's in Denver and I'm in New Jersey. And
this is shitty Green Lantern. Mm-hmm. So.
And Patrick just.
I've got a Borg.
He throws these things up on the screen. And
actually, this is
which no one can see, so it's lots of visual humor. And I'm like, that's great visual humor for the people that can't see this.
So that's Locutus. This is just a regular board.
Wow.
But yeah, I put these out all the time.
I'm sad I didn't bring anything.
Yeah.
Here.
These are the nerdy things that John gets to see.
It's like co-ed, or the other mnemonic is koala.
What's really fun is, so since we do this with video, I'll have the video, and I'll be sitting there talking with John, and all of a sudden, this guy will just float by.
I always thought that was a lot bigger. I guess it's just a perspective thing.
Yeah,
it is a perspective thing.
Was like,
so
it's a guardian.
Record on Skype?
We use
Google Hangout.
Yeah, the Google Hangout.
Record the video too.
No, we don't record the video.
Oh,
we just we use that.
You actually like look at each other.
Yes, to try to have a more natural conversation.
Yeah. And that way we can go.
Yeah.
Right.
Everybody remember when Data was Romulan for a little while?
Yes.
And then of course. I am Optimus Prime.
I have a fish pond.
Leader of the Autobots. And of course, I'm Batman.
And Groot.
So there, that makes me feel better. Now it's like I'm home.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, I think we can get started now.
Here, John, should we use the flashcards? Lynn, we also use flashcards on the video.
Nice.
Yeah, so we know when to...
See, we just interrupt each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Squeecast, it's just chaos.
Yes. Well, what happened was we would interrupt each other, and we would have problems, mm-hmm. and after, we would be very angry at each other.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I really wanted to talk. I really had something I wanted to say. Oh, I'm really sorry. I didn't know. You know, well, we'll figure it out next time.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So. All right.
So you
got your guitar?
No, they couldn't find one for me. I was going to do like the theme song live, but I decided not to bring my guitar for that, and no one would lend me one, which I don't blame them because I don't lend my guitar out to people either. So,
his arms don't even bend.
Yeah. We'll have to add that in later.
It's weird, right?
Yeah.
That's why I said he's like the shitty Green Lantern.
Yeah, he really is.
What is that, Kyle?
No, it is Hal, but it's the Ryan Reynolds Hal.
I like Kyle as a Green Lantern.
And plus, I mean, you got this guy and that guy, and they're, like, completely not proportional. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, yeah, I keep these guys around, and I, on the video, I do stuff like this to John. And like, when he's really deep in thought is when I try to pop something out just to see if he'll laugh. And by the way, you also have somewhere in here, somehow. You got R2-D2, and of course, R2-D2 brings the secret message of Princess Leia.
How cool is that?
That's good.
Taco Bell.
Yeah.
That was
so
Taco Bell.
I was about to do an audiobook, and I'm like, no, wait, wait, I need to save those.
Yeah, I understand.
So, my name is Patrick Hester, his name is John Anilio, and this is the first ever live Functional Nerds podcast.
Yay!
And we are outnumbered by the audience, so it's kind of cool.
Yeah. We're taking pictures now. That's
yeah.
We're taking pictures. We got toys out on the table. John's got some books.
Yeah, we have some books to give away later. So basically, I'll just have you guys arm wrestle for them at the end, I think. I think that's probably the fairest. I don't know. But that is Patrick Hester. He is an
I'm also
author.
Wearing my nerd shirt.
Yes, in case there was any confusion. But he is an author and a blogger and a Hugo Award-winning podcaster for the Esper Signal podcast. His website is atfmb.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I'm a musician and a podcaster. You could check our website out, functionalnerds.com.
Project, John, project.
I'm not projecting. I think I'm projecting pretty good. Anyway, I'll try to do a little more. You can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And today we are joined by Mary Robinette Cowell.
Yes.
Okay.
You didn't ask.
And I did ask.
He did.
Oh,
he did.
But I'll okay. still forget. She's a Campbell and Hugo Award-winning author of Shades of Milk and Honey, Glamour and Glass, Without a Summer, and Valor and Vanity. She's also an award-winning puppeteer and a voice actor. You can check her out at maryrobinettecowell.com, and you follow her on Twitter at maryrobinette. Mary, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This is very exciting.
I feel
so honored to be in the inaugural live broadcast or podcast.
Yeah.
We're not actually broadcasting.
No, we're not broadcasting.
No.
But it'll be online. But
yeah.
But basically, thanks to Capricorn for inviting us, because what happened was John and I would complain on the podcast, and we would say, you know, it kind of sucks that there's no con that we can go to together, because he's in Jersey, land of suntan and suntanning booths. And I'm in Colorado, land of pot. Rocky Mountain High, that's the new thing. And it's kind of hard for us to get together. And I'll go to Worldcon every year, and John's like, no, I'm not going to Worldcon. That's expensive, and I don't want to go. And I've got my kid, and I've got my wife, and I've got my job. And wah, wah, wah. So we were talking about this on air several times, and all of a sudden, Shadowcat, John...
Ickes
says, we've solved your problem. You're going to come to Capricorn. We're going to make you guests of honor. And we're like, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And so here we are, and we're doing this live for the first time. So it's kind of neat.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's been a great con so far. We're recording this on the Saturday at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
We still have our voices.
Yes. Yeah, for the most part, we're good. But it's been a really good con. They've been treating us really well. And I've gone to a couple panels.
We survived Barfleet.
Yes, we did that.
Well done.
First night, at least, anyway. And we're happy to have Mary join us today. Otherwise, it would just be me and Patrick playing with his action figures. And maybe we would just invite people to come up and play with the action figures as well. That still may happen.
No one touches the action figures.
No, dude.
But I did notice that Cap is missing his helmet. So.
Oh, that's not okay.
Well, I would say let's... Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, for those people not watching the video feed, he just knocked Cap face down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Terrible face plant.
It's yeah.
Devastating.
Well, and he's standing next to Kilowog, so really he's a pooza.
Yeah. Well, I think we should get into our picks of the week.
We have to do picks?
Yeah, we have to do picks. I have one. Do you have one?
Sure, I pick Capricorn.
All right.
Woohoo!
You're done. Okay.
You guys have no idea how stressful picks of the week are for me, because what happens is... John schedules everything for 12 o'clock his time. We batch record, which is 10 a.m. my time. I am not a morning person. I don't prep ahead of time. So what happens is about 9:53, I'll get my first cup of coffee. I'll run downstairs, and I'll be sitting there going, what's my pick? What's my pick? What's my pick? And then I'm going, I hope he asks the guest first. I hope he asks the guest first. I hope he asks the guest first. Sometimes he does. And then while he's doing that, I've got my laptop over here, and I'm searching. Fine.
It's like, this
something.
Is all stalling right
fine.
Now, isn't it?
Something. No, I already picked. Capricorn's
yeah.
my pick.
Okay.
I'm right. picking Capricorn 35. That's my pick.
Well, Mary, do you have your pick ready?
Yes.
Okay.
Mine is a series of books that I love. It is the Sarah Tolerance Mysteries by Madeline Robbins. And they're fantastic mysteries, but it's also set in an alternate history of the Regency where instead of Prince George being the regent, it's Queen Charlotte, which completely changes the balance of power in terms of women's roles. And Sarah Tolerance is an agent of inquiry. So you have a young lady who's going out and solving mysteries and generally kicking ass, and they're fantastic. And
how many books are in the series so far?
There are three or four. I can't quite remember, because sometimes I get arcs, so sometimes I'm like, wait, is the fourth book out? Or did I get a sneak preview of that? But anyway, they are fantastic.
Cool. Yeah, we were just talking about arcs before we started recording, and it's a fantastic problem to have, but you guys probably have the same experience. I sometimes get three copies of the same book between, I don't know if like some publicists are... There's more than one publicist on an author sometimes, and like I'll get two different arcs, and then I'll get the finished copy. Again, it's a nice problem to have.
It is a nice problem.
But I got Peter V. Brett's new book. I got two arcs on the same day from the same guy. Don't know why. I'm like, this is
sometimes
great.
I think they just kind of screw it up.
Yeah, I think so probably. But
so I have a second pick.
Okay,
Doug Boggs.
Oh yes, Doug. Doug, who's
guest of honor liaison, has been awesome.
Yes. Very much so.
Very, very awesome. Love Doug.
Yes.
And his son, Brandon.
Yes.
Who kicked my ass in Magic yesterday, big time.
Yeah.
He's a shark. He's a card shark. If he asks you to play Magic with him, beware.
My pick is going to be by I'm pretty sure he's a local author, and I think he would be here, but he is on Mount Kilimanjaro this weekend.
That is
Wesley Chu, who is, I think he's in Chicago. And I'm going to pick his book, Lives of Tao, which I finally got around to reading. We have all these awesome authors on the show, and sometimes I can read their books before they're on, sometimes they can't, and I'm always sort of catching up, and I finally got around to reading the first book, which I think there's two books out in that series now, and I think the third one is on the way. And I really enjoyed it. It's kind of, I saw it advertised as, or pitched as kind of the TV show Chuck, where like there's all these skills and this guy that's not a spy becomes a spy because an alien inhabits his body. So I was sort of thinking when I was first reading it, it's almost kind of like Stargate with the Gua'uld, but there's no, it's more of like a mystique.
Good pronunciation.
I watched like 17 seasons of Stargate. If you watch all of the seasons of Stargate, it's like 10 seasons of SG-1, it's 5 seasons of Atlantis, and it's 2 of Universe. So if you watch all of them, it's 17 seasons.
Universe seasons are heartbreaking because they end.
Yes, and it's on a cliffhanger. But anyway, so it is kind of like Gua'uld, but instead of like a snake going down your throat, it's more of like a misty kind of thing. But it's really cool because there is this sort of hero's journey aspect of it. There is a kind of a spy thriller part of it, and kind of a little bit of alt history, and it's there's a lot of really cool elements, and it's very action packed, and I really enjoy it. So it's The Lives of Tao, and I'm saying it that way because I listened to the audiobook, and that's the way they pronounced it. But it's Lives of Tao, which I guess usually you would pronounce it Tao, right?
Yeah.
But I've heard people pronounce it Lives.
So
of
what
Tao.
Was the name of the scientist guy in Universe?
Which one? They were all scientists.
No, the evil scientist guy who was kind of... he kind of forced him to go.
John Scalzi?
Well, the funny thing is, I was the one... I caught the old man's war placement in the show. And I have a DVR, so I rewound and I hit pause. And I took a picture of the screen of the guy going, I've got a book to read, And I tweeted it out with Scalzi's. I tagged him on it. And he retweeted it without tagging me. And I'm like, seriously, John? What the hell is this shit?
There was a period where Lou Anders was, and I'm sure he is, but I remember when this was happening, when he was pretty friendly with Joseph Malozzi, who does the production on a lot of the Stargate stuff. And there was stuff in Atlantis, I believe, where they were reading Pyre books. Where they didn't say anything about it. They were just like in their bunk with like, I think it was the Martian's daughter or something. Like, I forget which one of the ones it was, but I know there was a little bit of product placement going on with. And Malozzi was doing that at the time. He was doing like a book club every month too, which I think was really helpful because he had such a big platform and all of a sudden it was a lot of people reading this.
Because FYI, we had him on.
Yeah.
And we talked about Stargate Universe.
Oh, that's right. I remember. That was on SF Signal. That's one of the early episodes that I was still on before I bailed out, before you got nominated for Hugo's. I'm like the Pete Best of the
you are.
Of the SF Signal podcast.
Well, you know what? I've always said that all of my success and winning a Hugo Award for podcasting is due to Shauna McGuire's speech where she recused the Squeecast.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. But, you know, I was sort of thinking
I'm looking at Lynn Thomas, by the way.
She's sitting in the audience.
I wonder, you know, and maybe Mary can speak to this, because I have some specific Mary Robinette questions, too. But, you know, that what we were just talking about with the books, how important do you think, you know, we talked about Malazzi having that book club, mm-hmm. and then you have something like Sword and Laser has mm-hmm. a book club, and they have a pretty big reach. Whether you've seen it yourself, because I also noticed, like, I noticed I was looking at your Twitter feed today, and I think you retweeted one of Veronica Belmont's thing, which was, you know, books better than 50 Shades of Grey or sexier than 50 yeah. Shades of Grey. And I didn't get a chance to look, like, what were some, was one of your books on that?
No, it was just like, it's a good list.
Yes, yeah. So how important is someone like a Veronica Belmont or Joseph Malazzi or someone who has a very big audience and platform for kind of getting the word out about your either your books or authors that you've known? What do you think about that?
They're incredibly important. They're often called trendsetters, decision makers, gatekeepers. There are a lot of different words for it, but one of the things that remains the most effective way to sell a book is word of mouth and you know, getting the opinion of someone that you trust and admire. So someone that is in a position like a celebrity where they have a large footprint, they have a large footprint because frequently a lot of people trust and admire them. So when they have an opinion about something, other people will be like, oh, I will do that. The other thing is there's a theory in advertising that it takes 7 impressions to make a sale.
Yes, yeah.
So having somebody say, hey, here is this book, particularly on something like Twitter, if Veronica Belmont tweets, I like this book, and someone retweets her, and that person also happens to be someone that I'm following, then I see multiple people all suddenly talking about this book, and that's going to increase the likelihood that I will buy it. So it's incredibly important.
It's, you know, I remember being very aware of that when I first started doing, where I was trying to get some kind of a name for myself with my music about 7 or 8 years ago, and I read all these kind of marketing books, and I remember coming across that sort of 7 impressions. And if you notice with authors who are particularly savvy with this stuff, they do try to time it when their book's coming out, that they get on a lot of podcasts, they get interviewed, that they write guest posts. So you'll see, you know, a lot, and you'll see a couple people in the community kind of complain, but to me, it's exactly what you just said. It's like, you know, the 7th time you see, it's like, oh, okay. Like, yeah. It's almost like up until 6 impressions, it's like you're not even aware that it exists. It's almost like that 7th one, this is the first time you're like, oh, okay. So then you start paying attention. So it is kind of important, I think, to do that. So yesterday, you were on a panel about crafting story.
Yes.
And that was with yourself, and it was Gene Wolfe.
With Gene Wolfe.
And you,
did he tell you as well that he was circumcised?
You know, we had other conversations.
Okay.
No, they were doing shots during the panel, but Gene was there, and Matt Forbeck was there, and a couple other nice folks, and it was a really cool panel. And one of the things that you guys got to, which I really wanted to pick your brain about a little bit, is especially in there's a lot of sort of writer advice out there. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that write blogs or books about it, and a lot of it's good and it's fine, and it's something that I was, as I've talked about on the show recently, it's something I'm a little more interested in doing, even though I'm a musician. I'm sort of
It's still a form of writing.
Right, it's something that I'm kind of getting into. And a couple weeks ago on Twitter and Facebook, I was asking, because I have a lot of writer friends, like, what are, you know, what if you're getting started, and the analogy that I made is, as a musician, and you said this yesterday, with like every other artistic endeavor, you see this, but it doesn't kind of come up in writing a lot. As a musician, it was, okay, you're going to play these scales, and you're mm-hmm. going to learn how to do this. And there's literally hundreds of variations on the way you can practice scales, you know, just like different sequences, and then you're playing with your metronome, and you're, you know, you're playing eighth notes with your metronome, and then you're playing 16th notes with the metronome, and then all
etudes.
Of your harmony. Yeah, there's so much sort of study material, and it's like, you want to learn how to do this? Here's how you do it. Mm-hmm. And I am a guitarist, and that's a little more scattered, but especially with something like the piano or the violin.
Yeah.
It's like, this is what you have to do. Now what you do with it is could be artistically, there's
scales.
A huge range of things that you can do, but in terms of just getting to the base of the skills you need, there's usually a fairly clear path on how to do it. And when I was asking people, and I'm like, what are the scales of being a writer? I got what you said yesterday, which was like, you just got to sit down and do it.
That just drives me crazy, that advice.
Yeah, so I don't know if you could, I know you talked about this yesterday, I don't know if anybody was on the panel, and I don't want you to feel like you're repeating yourself, but I would love if you can share some of those things, because I found that very helpful. I was actually taking notes. I'm like, no, slow down, say that. I will do that then.
So yeah, I do have this theory that it is completely possible to break the different techniques of writing down into their individual components. So for description, and this is one of the ones I talked about on the panel yesterday, for description, the thing I say is to go and sit in a room and just describe the room for half an hour. And you're not, your pen or your fingers on the keyboard, whatever your writing tool, it's, you're not allowed to stop.
Mm-hmm.
You're just describing the room. And what's going to happen is that in the beginning, you will describe the fairly obvious things about the room. And the farther you get into this, about 5 minutes in, about 10 minutes in, depending on who you are, you'll think, there's no way I can continue describing this room. I've described everything in it. I hate Mary. It's very specific. Everybody hits this point. And then you'll continue going. And by the time you get to the end of the half hour, what's happened is that you've begun to notice all of the specific details about that make this space unique. Like, the room that we are in has... Okay, well, this room actually does have more than four walls just because it's got a weird shape in it.
It's got a weird shape, yes.
But, you know, if you describe a room and you're just like, well, it's got four brown walls, that doesn't actually tell you anything about the space. If you describe the low hiss of the air conditioner that's going to leave a mark on this recording, the orange extension cord that's plugged in the back of the room indicating that someone has forgotten to do their housekeeping maintenance, you know, the hole in the wall that, which is the kind of thing that I notice, where someone has taped something to the wall and they really should not do that at the hotel. That these are the things that make a room a little more specific. And what happens as you do this exercise over and over, and this is one that I actually will still do, is that you build a vocabulary for different spaces that you can reuse when you're telling a story, and that you also start to train yourself to look for those specific details first. So you get better at that. So that's one. And then I actually, when I'm teaching, I run my students through several iterations of that. So the first time I have them do that, I have them do it just as themselves, and they write it in third person, with themselves as the point of view character. And then the second time, I have them describe the same room, but from the point of view of someone with a specific job. And the idea is to try to describe the room in such a way that I know what the person's job is by the things they notice in the room. And then another iteration is to do the same thing, but this time the person has a specific mood. So, you know, like a ballet teacher who would walk in here would complain because with the, you know, I would describe the carpet, yes. I would say, you know, the dense brown carpet was absolutely inappropriate for toe shoes. There was no way she could rehearse in here. And, you know, I've told you that the carpet is there, and I've also told you that she's a ballerina without actually saying she's the ballerina looked at the room with the brown carpet. And so it's that kind of thing. And then the iteration that Eric suggested, which I do in a slightly different variation but similar, is describing it in different genres. Because every genre has its own technique. So if I tried to describe this room as a murder mystery room, you know, it's like the panel where the room divider was would be perfect for hiding a body. I think it would, actually. you know, versus romance or something like that. So that's that's description. And I usually start people with description, because as much as we say it's about, you know, show, don't tell, that particular piece of advice is fairly misleading, because we are in fact storytellers, and it is all telling. It is all writing down description. And once you learn to handle this, it also gives you the tools that you will need for handling exposition and things like that. For plot, I have people not use any of the other storytelling techniques. I just have them write like 150 words that describes beginning, middle, and end of the story. Don't even worry about character names. So, you know, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, I would say, you know, write the basics of Goldilocks and the Three Bears in 150 words. A little girl goes exploring, she finds a house, breaks a couple of things in it, and then bears come home, and it's clear that it belongs to them, and she runs away. You know, that's Goldilocks and the Three Bears. All the stuff in the middle is, you know, breaks some things.
Now, you were saying that you teach us. Now, do you teach? Do you do like an online course? Do you do what's your teaching like?
I do online courses, and then I also at conventions I will teach intensives and master classes, and sometimes just the okay. I have the short stories explained for novelists, mm-hmm. Things like that.
What are your online course like? How does that work? Does it? Do you do like a? Do you sort of give assignments, mm-hmm. or do you do like video kind of talky stuff, or like how do you?
Yes, okay. All of that.
All of that.
I do for my short story intensive. It's online. I use Google Hangouts, so mm-hmm. I have 8 students at a time. We start at 7 o'clock on Friday night. They get a pre-class assignment, which is the describe a room,
mm-hmm.
And then we do assignments in class. There are 7 sessions that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Each one is a different technique, and we build on the techniques as we go. So they get an assignment at the end of. So I lecture. I offer. They give questions. I give them an assignment. They go away. They do the assignment. They come back. We critique the assignment in class. Because I feel like critiquing is a very important part of training yourself as a writer. And
do you teach them to critique?
Yes,
to
I do.
Accept critiques?
Yes, I do. That is, I okay. do. And actually, I have a video that's on YouTube that I make them watch before they do the first one, which is how to train your internal editor.
It's super important, too, because what happens is if you have only ever had your mom tell you how great your writing is, and then you go to a critique group and they're like, wow, this is shit.
Yeah. Well, first of all, a critique group should not say this.
Right, but I mean, that's how your inner voice is going to translate what they're telling you.
Yeah.
And I've seen people leave critique groups just in tears. I've also seen them storm out because they were expecting to be told that their story was the greatest thing that's ever been written before, and to have someone say it wasn't destroyed them.
Yeah, and I do think that's, I mean, you really do have to set expectations and teach people what the purpose of a critique is and how to interpret the information that they're getting from that. And that's one of the things that I learned when I was in art school, because again, you know, that's a skill that's actually taught in art school.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I completely agree with you that's so important.
Yeah. So to take the other end of it, I'd spent a lot of time doing, songwriters groups, many years ago. And it was, see, I think what you're talking about is you're really moderating it. I think the, you're teaching it, you're moderating it, so you can really set the tone of it. When you just have kind of groups that are kind of everybody as equals, I think those can be great and those can be terrible, because I was in some songwriters groups that were great and then some that were terrible, because I think when you're having this critique, sometimes people feel like they have to say something. Like, and you also don't want, I was in a guitar master class when I was in college, and it was all 19-year-old kids, and we didn't know how to say anything. So everybody would, and we were going to go up next, so we weren't going to trash the person and then go up and then get. So it was always like, it was good, it was good. And our professor was just like, you have to say more than that. What about his tone? Was his tone? What was it? Was, you know, could he be better with this? Was his tone? And it's like, no, it's good. Except there's one guy. I think he must be a critic now, because. He had some good things to say, but he would be just scathing on all of us. And I remember the first couple of weeks of this master class, you know, he just, like, ripped everybody. And I remember the whole time thinking, like, this guy must be great. he must be so good if he has like the balls to just like rip everybody. And he got up there. Now, I sort of feel a little bad about it. At the time, I didn't feel bad at all. But like he got up there and like he just started like shaking. Like, he was so nervous, and, like, part of me felt bad, like, oh, but why are you so outspoken? And, like, okay, if I was going to go up there and start shaking because I couldn't get through a piece, like, I wouldn't remember it. But I think having someone set the parameters and set the guidelines, and there's ways that you can, you know, sort of dive into a certain aspect of it, and it's not, I would imagine, you have to put it in a way where you're not critiquing them as a human being.
Right.
I think that's what it's really has to get down.
Typically, because I've found in a couple groups now, you set ground rules ahead of time. You say, look.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing that's being said is personal. They're not attacking you. They're not attacking anything. They're just telling you how your words impacted them and what they're seeing with it. I've known there's a guy that critiques for me. I've known him for years. If you have anything with any kind of weapons, from ancient weapons to modern weapons, this guy is your guy, and he will tell you, no, that's not the right sword, that's not the right gun, that's, you know, don't call it a clip. And I mean, he'll just he's all over that, but he doesn't like short stories. And if you give him a short story, his critique will always be, I'd rather it be a novel.
Yeah.
I want it to be a novel. He doesn't want a short piece.
Yeah, well,
that's not helpful.
And I think that's something too. I was listening to it on some other podcast where they were talking about with movies and like with critics, something like a comedy. And a lot of times comedies don't get reviewed that well, and it's kind of unfair because you're not judging it. You're judging it in terms of every movie that's being made. And I think when you have a comedy, for instance, or like an action movie, let's say, it's like, well, what did this movie set out to be? Did they achieve that?
Yeah.
Then this should be a good review, because if it's, I don't know, let's say an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie or something, the people that go to see that, myself included, like, I know what I want out of that movie. And did they deliver that? Then that's what it should be judged on. It shouldn't be judged on like, oh, well, I only like, you know, late romantic. And it's like, well, then maybe this book wasn't for you. Maybe you shouldn't review or critique. So, I don't know, maybe the person in your group, Patrick, needs to recuse himself from critiquing short stories.
Anyway.
Yeah, and I do feel like one of the things that's important when you're looking for people to read something is to make sure that you are getting readers who read the kind of thing that you are trying to write.
Sure.
Because otherwise, like, if I'm writing a Regency romance and I hand it to somebody who prefers military SF, he's going to be like, there aren't nearly enough submarines in this. I'm like, oh, okay, so I should add in some submarines. All right,
But on the flip side, I do like giving stories to people who don't read science fiction and fantasy, because they come up with all kinds of insights that you never even thought of.
Absolutely.
And they'll come up with a lot of character stuff. They'll be like, oh, well, you know, I didn't really get all the magic crap, but this character didn't speak to me.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't feel three-dimensional.
But I think that you have to be a fairly savvy writer and familiar with critiques before you're able to parse that kind of thing.
Sure.
You know, I don't know that that's something that a newer writer is going to be able to parse as well, because they're still trying to sort out how to interpret critiques in the first place. It's not that they shouldn't. It's just that it's a thing to be aware of.
Yeah, now, I agree with that.
Let me ask you this in terms of teaching. Have you found, and I can speak to my own experience as a teacher too with this, have you found, what are the positives for your writing from teaching it?
Oh, yeah. Having to unpack my own process makes such a difference. And one of the things that happens all the time is, like, I'll be explaining something to someone, and as I'm explaining it to them, my brain is thinking about a problem with a story that I have been having. I'm like, oh, that's why I can't do that. Or this piece of information that I totally know and I have forgotten to apply to my own writing. There's some of that. But it unpacking stuff makes me aware of my own process so that I can do things with more intention. And also helps me being able to better diagnose when my own fiction goes astray. which is also, again, one of the reasons that I feel like it's really, really important for new writers to get practice at critiquing, because it's another way of separating out a skill set. I feel like critiquing is a form of doing scales for writers, because it allows you to evaluate something without having to do it at the same time. We have a lot of opportunities to do that as in other forms, but you know, where you're listening to music and then you read the review of the music. There's not as much with writing for most people.
So I have a question for Mary Robinette, but before I do, I have to set it up.
Huh.
Did you guys know that she really likes handwritten letters? Did you know that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. She really likes the handwritten letter. Which she'll probably never get from me because my handwriting is
not that
so
bad.
Horrible.
I have to tell you.
Really?
Oh,
I think it's horrible.
I can. It's not. You know, fine penmanship, but
no.
That's totally legible.
Not.
And honey, I could show you.
So I'm being a nerd. I'm always curious how people write their drafts. Do you handwrite your drafts? Do you do them in a computer?
Oh, I do them on a computer.
You do them in a computer.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have handwritten. I will actually in here. I think in my this is a section of stuff that is it's the beginning of a new short story.
And I want to point out that all three of us have notebooks, paper, and pen, and we're sitting here. Well, I'm doodling.
Yeah.
But they're actually writing notes. So.
Yes. Yeah, so this is I do write stuff by hand when I'm waiting for things. But I draft on computer.
Okay.
I will occasionally use a typewriter.
I love a typewriter. I miss typewriters.
I have 17 of them.
I know. I actually sent her pictures of one at Mount HighCon. It had a completely different keyboard. It was old. It was not very big. It was the neatest.
Yeah.
Neatest little.
That's 17 more typewriters than most people have.
I know. They're beautiful machines and really durable if you take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about writing, the mechanism that you use to write actually influences the way you compose.
Okay.
So I will sometimes hack my own brain by switching mechanisms. For instance, there are parts of, not all of, Without a Summer, there's a section that I wrote using an actual quill pen, you know, like actual feather.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was like, well, Jane Austen could do it, surely. And it turns out that it's a very comfortable thing to write with. I thought it was going to be a lot harder, and I thought I would have to dip more often. Got about four lines, not four sentences, but four lines of text. But what I discovered was that the action of dipping... So I would write, the pen would be running out of ink, I could see it was running out, I would go and dip, and during the process of dipping and wiping and coming back, I would be composing more of the sentence. And so my sentence structures got much longer and more complex. And also because I was writing more slowly than I do with a computer, I was doing a lot of my editing in my head before I put the words down on the page, because I could think much faster than I write. Typing, I type close to the same speed that I'm composing, which means that my editing is happening after it hits the page. Now, the other thing that was happening was that because the typewritten page is easier to scan over, my scenes, like when I sat down, I could scan over what I had written and then continue on. And so my scenes were much more coherent. But in the quill, my scenes were not as coherent because I couldn't scan back through what I had read. So it was really interesting. I went with more complex sentence structures, but I had larger structure issues with one form. But it was very interesting. And typing also, as opposed to keyboarding, but using an actual typewriter, again, you wind up with that thing where at the end of the line, I actually manually return to the next line. And during that manual return, I'm again composing some. When I reach the end of the page and I pull it out, there's again some of that composition happening while I'm feeding it in. So, and that one, it's easy to scan back through. It's harder to go back and edit and change. It's easier to edit and change with a pen and paper than it is with a typewriter. So typewriter is really good for forward momentum. And so I wind up with slightly longer, more complex sentences and more forward momentum, but but I do less going back and editing. So depending on what's going on with my writing, what I need, I will sometimes deliberately switch my medium to force that mindset to happen.
I had a completely manual typewriter.
Yeah.
And so what I ended up with was paper that was curved like this, because it would sit in the typewriter for a week. Because if I took it out, there was no way in hell I was going to get it lined up exactly. This was a really old one.
Yeah.
But if you guys may know, I was born here in Chicago. I went to St. Odello down in the Berwyn-Cicero area, and I broke this hand in the first grade.
That is his right hand for the
right
people
hand,
not watching the video.
Yes. Yes. I broke my right hand in the first grade when you're learning how to write.
Oh.
And I started writing with my left hand, and my dad flipped out and told the nuns not to let me write with my left hand because he didn't want a southpaw. He didn't want a left-handed son.
Wow.
So I was way behind, so that's why I think my handwriting sucks. But it's interesting you talk about the method, because that manual typewriter, I would push the key and it would hit and nothing would happen. And I would push it again and it would hit and I would see the faintest little thing. And so I realized I had to pound that keyboard to get it to do stuff. So today, I still, when I'm typing, people think I'm angry at the keyboard. Because I'm still pounding. It's like I learned how to play guitar on a high action guitar, which means the strings are really high off of the fret.
Oh, yeah.
So I have to push down really hard to get it to make a tone. So if I get something with low action, again, people think I'm trying to like tear the strings off the guitar because I'm like, rah!
Well, and that brings it back a little bit what you were talking about with teaching, with unpacking your... Because I think what happens, depending on your background, whatever skill you're learning. And when I was learning how to play the guitar, I taught myself for a year before I ever had a teacher. So, of course, I picked up a lot of bad habits, as you tend to do when you self-teach yourself. And then I had teachers, and then I went to college. But what happens when you're going through this big process of learning whatever it is you're learning, some things are harder for you, so you have to work on them, and some things you just kind of intuitively get, and you do it, and you don't ever really think about it that much. And I remembered once I started teaching a lot, and especially when I started teaching a lot privately, there would be these things that were just so intuitive to me, and a student would ask about it. Like, so something like with strumming. I never thought about strumming.
Yeah.
Like, that was something that is hard to do at first, but then eventually you just kind of get it. And as a teacher, you can't say, you'll just get it. It's just do it for a while. It's kind of like, just sit down and write a note. It's like, and I remember students asking this, and I'm like, all right, I have to figure out what I'm doing and how I can teach it to them. And eventually I did. I found some good books on it, and I found some like, oh, and you know what? My technique got better because I was much more aware of what I was doing and then just doing it different ways. Guitar is a weird instrument, though. I will say that, because as opposed to, say, piano or violin, where there is accepted technique, and that's pretty much it. Guitar, there's all sorts of different schools of playing.
Finger playing.
Which are pretty...
I was going to say that is also true for violin.
Oh, really? There is a lot of different...
Do you know what the difference between a violin and a fiddle is? The way you play it.
The twang.
Yeah, that's true, too.
The twang?
Well, I was thinking even... that's a different... You know, this classical violin. I was thinking
it's also
classical.
The way you hold it.
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah. Because even within, say, rock guitar players, you'll have guys that... there's a certain kind of picking technique. And I'm talking about just playing with the pick. I'm not even talking about finger style. But there are some guys that all have beautiful techniques. Some guys hold the pick between their thumb and their first finger. One of my favorite players is this guy, Steve Morse. He holds it with three fingers like this at a totally different angle, and he does this. And it, like, where he's just, like, doing this three fingers with his hand in the complete different motion. I could never even get a sound that way. It's a totally weird, but that's the way he did it, and that's the way.
And I like Clapton and, like, Derek Trucks because they finger pick.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just sitting there finger picking. It's like classical.
Yeah,
and that's another whole. And again, it gets back to like these exercises. When I started learning how to play classical guitar, it was, you said etudes. You know what was a big thing and still is, but there would composers would write instead of just having scales, where it's just like they were actual pieces of music, but they were little short that were focused on developing of specific techniques. So you could find these sort of etude books that start out quite simply, and then by the end, they're like super hard, because it's just like, all right, you know, harmonic minor scales, 16th notes, go. And it's just like all this crazy stuff. But it does sort of build up your technique.
Now, see, I did scales with piano, but I never did scales with guitar.
Huh.
With guitar, I started picking up sheet music, figuring out the chords, and playing the songs by ear.
Wow.
What a lot of, like, the sort of, you know, when you're talking about guitar players, when you have, like, your Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page and all those guys, a lot of what those guys did was not, I would imagine a lot of those guys never had a guitar lesson, other than just like, here's a C chord, go nuts, kid.
Well, yeah, Stevie Ray Vaughan, the legend is that he stole Jimmy Vaughan's guitar, his older brother, stole the guitar, locked himself in a bedroom for 12 hours until his fingers were bleeding, until he could play the damn guitar.
Well, and what I was going to say with what I think all those guys did at the time was, this was when, I know there's like a resurgence in vinyl now, but at the time that was the only way to listen to music. But the good thing about that was that they could slow the record down.
Yeah.
So that is how every guitar magazine interview I ever read with a guitar player from that era was, I would get a Muddy Waters record or whatever, one of the old blues guys, and, you know, they were just huge, especially the English. The English were, like, such massive fans of American music, of, like, the blues and everything, and it was just...
To the point where they got sued for stealing it.
Well, that was when Led Zeppelin wasn't crediting, when they actually took songs from it, but that's besides... But the point is that, like, they were just so immersed in it, and then they would just sit and try to make the sound that they heard on the record, which I think is kind of interesting, and I wonder how many writers go through this, too. By trying to mimic it,
yeah,
they could never really get it, and the way that they went about doing it. So I know, like, even with someone like B.B. King, he heard, like, a slide guitar player, and he tried to make that, but he didn't know they were using a slide, which a slide is like a little metal tube or a glass tube. I think it's a Coricidin bottle. That's what Dwayne Allman used.
Beer bottle neck. A lot of people will cut those off, grind them, smooth them.
Well, I know Dwayne Allman used, I think it was called Coricidin, which is like this, like a medicine, like a tonic from like back in the 60s that you can get, and it was like the perfect size for his fingers. So anytime you see Dwayne Allman, like pictures of Dwayne Allman, that's like a little medicine bottle on his finger, because you couldn't just go to the guitar store and say, hey, give me a piece of metal. But anyway, that was the way I saw a lot of the blues guys played. B.B. King didn't know that, so he has this great finger vibrato because he was trying to mimic what a slide is. So I think, can you think of any examples of like sort of an analog in writing?
Oh,
where,
yeah. No, actually,
I was going to ask her, because I like fan fiction. A lot of times people try to copy the style of the author.
Yeah, so fan fiction is one option, but actually one of the techniques that I use and recommend for other people, depending on the kind of thing that you're trying to do, but if you're trying to mimic someone's voice, I say grab a piece of their text and re-key it into your, which is basically, so I put it next to the computer and I type it into the screen.
Meaning
verbatim.
Okay.
Verbatim. What that does is it wires your brain, it causes you to process the words in a slightly different way, but it forces you to think about where the punctuation is, and it's much like what you used to do in art, where you would try to copy the great masters. Mm-hmm. It's what you do when you're slowing down a record and trying to copy that particular sound in that particular album. And so what you wind up doing is it rewires your brain a little bit to incorporate those rhythms into your head. So like when I was working, and I still actually do this, when I'm doing the Jane Austen with magic novels, the first novel I would start and I re-keyed in the first scene of Persuasion. And then I started writing, and at the end of every chapter, I would read a chapter. Every time I finished a chapter, I would read a chapter of Persuasion, and then I would start writing the next chapter of my book. So that's one thing that I think is actually an invaluable tool. And fan fiction, as you say, is another one, because what you're doing there is that gives you the opportunity. Someone else has already come up with the characters and the world. So those are two pieces of technique that you don't have to deal with. And it allows you to focus on plot and as you say, trying to match voice. But I also think that sometimes just even sitting down and writing a sentence, and I haven't done this in years, but diagramming somebody else's sentence is another way.
We just talked about diagramming,
yeah,
didn't we?
Yeah. But diagramming a sentence is another way to go, oh, okay, so this is how they put it together. I will also, one of the other techniques that I recommend when you're trying to figure out plot and structure is to take a book and reverse engineer an outline from it.
Yeah, so Murr has done that before. A lot of times she'll use Star Wars as an example of how to reverse engineer a story mm-hmm. and say, you know, here's the hero, here's the plot, here's what's happening, here's the twist, here's the this and that. And she'll break that down that way. So yeah. that's a really interesting way of doing it.
Yeah, and then you can take those and then mm-hmm. apply them forward. Doing fairy tale retellings is another really, it's very much the same thing. Someone has already done the plot. And so, and it's a time-tested plot that we know because people keep retelling Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you take Beauty and the Beast and you're like, okay, but this time I'm going to set it in New York with an ice skater and a hockey player, you know, mm-hmm. which is a terrible film. But
and by the way, in case you guys did not realize this, Princess Leia is now a Disney princess.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there is a great comic out there where she's handing blasters out to all the other ones, telling them, save yourself from now on.
Yeah.
That's right. You know, you're talking about kind of some of these different tasks that you can do, or just some of these exercises that you can do that internalize things. And mm-hmm. I think that's something that's hard to teach. But I think ultimately, when you can start internalizing things, that's when you can really start doing
yes.
stuff. One of the things that I talk about with my students, with my own, you know, learning about music was. Because I'm an elementary school teacher, and I teach both. I teach all of the instrumental classes, so I teach all your flute and clarinet and saxophone and all that, and then I teach general music as well, which is from preschoolers up to fifth graders with just singing and movement and all that kind of stuff. And especially the boys, they tend to be pretty down on singing by the time they're like in fourth, fifth mm-hmm. grade. So they get pretty, although in my district it's pretty good because I'm a man and I'm singing all the time. So it's a, and.
Except on the podcast.
I'm the only one that sings more on the podcast than I do. But because, I don't know, maybe this is not even the right thing, but because I'm the music teacher and I'm a fairly masculine music teacher, so they're like, all right, I think it's okay if yeah. I do that. And I think that's, it's an important.
Having a model is really important.
Yeah, and when I try to tell some of the boys that are into playing the saxophone or whatever, I said, like, I didn't really become a very good musician until I started singing a lot. And I didn't really start singing a lot until I was in college, because I had that awesome Catholic school experience that a lot of people have where, you know, when your voice is changing and you're singing in choir and they're just like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't sing in choir anymore, because you know, you have no control of your voice is kind of all over the place, and it's, you know, I'm of the opinion that with singing, I think everybody can sing. It's most adults, or many adults, have hang-ups about doing it. It has
yes.
nothing to do with their physical part of singing, but singing internalizes music,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I teach, you know, with all like the solfege and the hand signals, with the method is called Kodai, and he has an awesome name. His name is Zoltán Kodály, but it's spelled K-O-D-A-L-Y. He was a Hungarian
That's
composer.
That's a great name.
Yeah, it's a Greek name?
No, great name.
Yeah. So yeah, I believe he was Hungarian, and I just like saying Kodály because it looks like Kodály, but you say Kodály. but it's all like the hand signals and people are singing all your meat. So and having sort of that scale kind of internalized here, you then can put that through your instrument. And I think that's something that it takes a while. But you were talking about with doing all these like writing exercises. I imagine that's sort of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like by doing this and doing this and mm-hmm. doing this, all of a sudden it's internalizing all
yes.
of these things.
Yeah, that is exactly the thing. And one of the things I talk to my students about is that when they finish a writing class, and this is true for anybody's writing class, but that when you come out of it, that there will be a period of time where writing is hard. Because you've taken something that you've been doing unconsciously and you're suddenly having to think about it. And during the process of internalizing it, it's like you have to think about it all the time, and so it can be like up to a year. And I know a lot of people will go take a writing class and they come out and it's hard and they think, well, I can't write, and they stop.
Mm-hmm. You hear about this a lot with like the big writing workshops.
Mm-hmm.
So like Clarion,
yeah, I hear that
yeah.
a lot.
And Odyssey and different ones, they will go and it's so intense and they're having to write so much that when they get back home, they suddenly find that they don't write for like a year.
Yeah. I think one thing, I know a lot of people will, like they'll come into my class and I'm the third or fourth workshop they've taken that year and they're planning to take some more. And I actually think, particularly with something like writing, and actually, I mean, other forms too, that when you are dealing with a whole bunch of different teachers, what we're all actually teaching you is, this is how I write.
Right.
And you have to go through this internalization process. But I actually think that you should not sign up for another workshop until you know what it is, what specific thing it is that you need to be working on.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise what you do, what you wind up is with a whole bunch, it's like moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you move and you've got a whole bunch of boxes and you have to unpack the boxes and find places for all of these things to go. And if you keep going to workshops, you're going to keep getting all of these boxes, but you're never going to have time to put the things away and decide where each of the pieces go. And if you even want to keep them all,
mm-hmm.
you just have boxes that you keep having to move around.
Well, and I keep wondering, I personally believe that there are people who just go from workshop to workshop, and
yeah.
they never write, they never actually put anything out there.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish that they would take... I knew someone who sat there and was handwriting everything in notebooks and was telling me about this great book that she was going to write. And I'm like, well, how long have you been working on it? Oh, about 10 years. And how many of these notebooks do you have? About 50. And is it all the book? No, this is all the backstory and the history and then this and that. And I said, okay, so tomorrow you're going to start writing the book.
Yeah. At the same time, I have to say that I think that one of the other problems that I have sometimes with writing as a culture is that we put so much pressure on people to publish. And that is...
I don't want her to publish, but I want her to start writing. I want her to actually write the book.
But she is writing, and she's doing the part of the process that gives her pleasure, which is the backstory and the planning. The writing of the book may not give her pleasure. This is like saying to a musician, you know, I know that you are perfectly happy playing these scales, but at some point you actually have to go out and, you know, you have to go out and sit in a gig, or you have to learn Rachmaninoff or something. You have to step up. And it might be that what gives this person pleasure, like my husband enjoys just noodling around on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
He is not actually interested in doing anything beyond that. And I think that we should allow people to have the people who want writing as a hobby should be able to do that. And the people who want to do writing as a career, yes, they absolutely have to stop noodling.
And this person did.
See, then, yeah, okay,
in that case. And they did, and I need to put that in context.
Yeah.
This is a person who's at a writing convention, at a conference, at a workshop to get published, and they're talking about how they haven't written a single word of their story yet.
Yeah, no, that is a different animal, and there I will completely agree with you 100%.
I want to continue with this conversation, but everybody that's in the audience, I want you now, because Mary did this yesterday in the panel that we were on, and I thought this was good. She actually did it in the very beginning, but I want you to think of, I want to give you a few moments to think about any questions that you may have, either for what we're talking about or for Mary or Patrick or myself specifically. So give yourself a couple of minutes. We're going to kind of continue on here, and then we'll maybe take a few questions and start to wrap things up. One of the things that we didn't talk about, which I want to know how much affects your day. You were a puppeteer for quite a long time. Are you still doing puppeteering now? Or?
No, since we moved to Chicago, I have not been. The last puppetry thing I did was of any significance was last year, almost exactly a year ago. I went to a Sesame Street workshop,
mm-hmm.
which was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street?
I can, actually. Take the Q train. And but the thing is... that one of the with puppetry, you have to, you know, you're working with other people, and when you move to a new community, you have to reestablish in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And the move to Chicago coincided with the writing career taking off.
Right.
And so I just, like, we actually, when we moved to Chicago, my book had just come out, my second novel had just come out, and we were actually doing book tour on the drive to Chicago. We were stopping at different bookstores and doing book tour there. So we got to Chicago, and I just haven't had time to reestablish. And it's, you know, so I have a shadow puppet show that I do when I'm on tour with the books, I use puppetry when I'm teaching. Patrick is doing a shadow puppet with his fingers right now,
yes.
A bunny.
On the table.
Yeah. It's a nice bunny, actually.
Yeah, it is. It's not bad.
And the question that I wanted to kind of ask about that is, and I think you've kind of already answered it, but do you find that you can do both at the same time?
I could when I was in Portland, and
okay.
I could when I was in New York. I can definitely balance. One of the things, I'm really grateful that I come to writing from theater because, I've spent most of my life having a freelance career.
Mm-hmm.
And writing is another freelance career. And a lot of people, when they say, I'm going to go be a full-time writer, what they don't realize is that they're going from having a full-time job to having a freelance career.
Mm-hmm. Which means going from having a paycheck to not having a paycheck.
Well, coming from having a paycheck, whether you go, it's not whether you work or not.
Sure,
but,
no, but it's the steady paycheck.
Yeah, it's the steady paycheck.
That you know you're going to get on a certain schedule.
Exactly. And with writing, if I'm not working, and the same with theater, if I'm not working, I'm unemployed. So a vacation it's not the same thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do vacations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm unemployed. And so when I started writing, it was another income stream. And that was the other thing that I was always trained, was that you had a diverse income stream. So I would just balance it and use the same criteria that I used to balance which puppet project I was working on. And that was, will it pay my rent? And when is it due?
Mm-hmm.
Those were the two pieces. And what am I trying to procrastinate on? That was the third, which sometimes trumped the others. But
I like to procrastinate on my lists.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Oh, is that Jody Lynn in the back?
It is.
It's when last night up in one of the parties, Matt Forbeck and who's the author guest of honor here, and John Bivens, who's the art guest of honor here, they were talking about this because they're both freelancers, and that is something Matt is particularly good at, is managing all, because he writes a lot. Matt writes a lot of stuff. He writes for games and a lot of
he's diversified.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And
he does the Kickstarters. He is the Kickstarter king,
mm-hmm. And he's just a writer that. Just he stays really on top of it. He's very organized. But what he and John Bivens were talking about was the importance of deadlines. Because sometimes if they have like sort of friends that want them to do some work for maybe not as much, and it's like, well, you got to give me a deadline because it's never going to get done.
Yeah.
You have to tell me when you want it because I have lots of other work that needs to be done. So if you don't give me a deadline, you're not getting it. What do you want?
Yeah, because you keep shuffling it to the bottom of the pile because you prioritize the things that are due.
Yeah.
And the things that are going to pay well.
Yeah. And one of the, this, with your puppeteering, I read a book a couple months ago. The name of the book is misleading and not very good, but it's actually quite a good book. It's called Make Art, Make Money.
I actually narrated that book.
No way! Wow, I did not know that. So I read the book. It's by, it's Lessons from Jim Henson on Fueling Your Creative Career, and it's by Elizabeth Hyde Stevens. And I got a lot out of the book because it's almost like a biography of Jim Henson in terms of how he figured out how to balance those things. There's some really cool stories about, having the rights to his characters and keeping them, and how he didn't, like when he did Sesame Street, the Sesame Street characters, he didn't really want to do that at first, and he didn't really want to have the toys, but what he kind of held on to was, well, if you're going to do toys, I have to do like that. They have to go through me, and all those toys were good and educational, and it allowed him to do what he wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
He made enough money with that. So it's really interesting. If you're into any of this stuff, that's a good book. Or get the audiobook that Mary Robinette is narrating. But I think we should.
Do you do any voices in the audiobook?
I don't, because it's nonfiction. I do them in fiction. But I did win a golden earphone for it.
Ooh, cool.
Nice.
That's a nice bit of synergy that I actually...
Anyway.
Okay, hopefully you guys have been thinking, and does anybody have any questions about anything we talked about, Mary, or Patrick, or myself?
Or anything else
that we didn't
talk about?
I will answer questions about anything, even things I don't know about. I mean, I might be lying to you as I'm answering it, but I'll answer it.
So I do have the answer to one question that was asked earlier. Yes, the cannolis were good.
Oh, you did get cannolis.
I did. This gentleman right here met me in the lobby with cannolis.
Good.
Wow.
That's very well done.
Exactly. So no questions at all?
I have a question for Mary.
Yes.
Please.
I happen to know that you sew.
So, yes.
So, sewing is a hobby for you. It's not something you're doing as part of your freelance career. How does the skill set that you gain and the pleasure that you get from sewing feed into your freelance work?
Great.
Does it?
So, do you think that's going to show up on the...
It will.
Okay.
There's magic involved.
Okay.
Magic
then,
woo.
Then I'm not going to repeat the question. One of the things that I realized at a certain point was I had puppetry, and that was a hobby, and then it became my career. And then I had writing, and that was a hobby, and then it became my career. So I have very stubbornly resisted allowing the sewing to become my career. Although I am bartering with this friend who's knitting me some things in return for me making a wedding dress. But, you know, besides that, the thing that I did the sewing the first time as research. I was going to the Oregon Regency Society, and I'm writing these Regency books, and I saw all of these women who had made their own dresses, and I had hired someone to make my dress, and I thought, well, wait a minute, Mary, you make puppets, you have all of these hand sewing skills. There's absolutely no reason you can't make this dress. So I decided to try to make one. And then I decided to try to entirely hand-stitch one because I was curious about how long it would take. This is not actually something that turns up in the novels, in any sort of real form, except there's one where I have Jane taking a dress apart and retrimming it because that was something the Regency ladies did, and I knew that that was something that a young lady might do sitting on her own. But the real way that it plays in, you know, okay, I say it's for research, and with all of these scare quotes and air quotes around that you can possibly throw. But the real thing that happens is that writing today, because I'm writing on a computer, I finish my writing day and I close the computer and I have absolutely nothing to show for what I've done. And I sit down and I sew and I finish. And there is a dress, and I can show that to people, and I can see the progress that I've been making. And because it is a tangible thing, because it is tangible and repetitive, because, you know, I'm sewing a straight seam, and then there's a little bit of, okay, well, how's this piece going to go together? There's a little bit of problem solving, but mostly it's repetitive stuff that's easy to put down. What I will sometimes do is I'm writing, I'm stuck. Rather than going and surfing the internet, I have the dress next to me and I will pick up and I will sew for a little bit while I'm thinking about my problem. And having that tangible thing and making progress on something will sometimes unlock the plot problem that I'm doing, and then I'll go back and do that. But mostly it's an opportunity to dress in pretty, pretty clothes.
So. one of the things I wanted to piggyback on with that is this kind of tangible thing, because it's a lot like with a lot of the music that I've done, it's all in computers. Like, I play instruments and everything too, but it all just exists as electrons on your hard drive. Mm-hmm. So
electrons, John?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, there you go. Another kind of like creativity book that I read and I enjoyed was by this guy Austin Kleon, and he talked of one of the
Austin Kleon?
Kleon.
Darn it.
Austin Kleon. But he talked about how when he does his work, and he does all sorts of different like artistic things, but how he has a digital desk and he has an analog desk. So he has two desks in his room, which I don't have a big enough room to have two desks. I'm lucky if I get to be at the dining room table in the morning before everybody gets up. But what he does is he just has all of his pens and notebooks and different, you know, he does some like art where he's like, you know, he has glue and all that, and all that's there. And then on his other table, he has his computer where he does some sort of digital editing. And he kind of goes back and forth between the two because I kind of agree with him, is that having things to actually manipulate with your hands and to have in front of you, I think is something that we've lost, and I think it's really quite beneficial to do it. So if you do any kind of creative work, I've been doing a lot of just kind of I do these things called morning pages from the Artist Way book, and I've been doing that every morning where I've been using this book that's in front of me, and it's just you just write and you write three pages in the morning. Doesn't have to be fiction, and just write. It's sort of just like a journal, but I'm actually doing something with my hand and it's not just me thinking or whatever. So I found that to be quite helpful too.
There have been a lot of studies that show that teaching children to write cursive mm-hmm. builds very specific pathways in the brain. And that a lot of it has to do with that's how you learn your fine motor control. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do that, then you don't have fine motor control as an adult. But I think that building of neural pathways is part of the reason why having something tangible is so beneficial, even as an adult, mm-hmm. that helps keep parts of your brain active that otherwise would atrophy a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And isn't it sad that cursive is dying?
Well, there's been a big push to bring it back, actually, because...
They still teach it in schools.
Some schools,
yeah.
Not all.
Yeah, and like that's the funny thing. In doing this the last month or so, I've like figured out how to write cursive again, because I wasn't, because I mm-hmm. do everything on a computer where
I
write print.
Cursive. And as you were saying, this is legible. It's legible because it's not cursive.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's funny. It does come back to you,
yeah,
though, because I've been doing it.
No. I had actually several meetings with my mom and various teachers who are going, we don't know why he's writing the way he's writing cursive, but it's not what we're teaching, and we don't know what's going on in his brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that seems like a good place to end it. On
my brain.
Yeah. But everybody, thank you so much for coming today.
So for the listeners, someone stuck their head in and gave John 5-minute signal, so he's like, stop!
Yeah, that's the way I do it.
That's what happens on the podcast,
yeah,
too. I'll get in the 5-minute thing, and he'll just stop whatever he's doing and say, okay, well, that seems like a good place to wrap up. Let's go ahead and...
Well, I get criticized of ending too abruptly, but you know what?
That's okay.
It can't be perfect.
So, Mary Robinette, what is your website? And your Twitter and all that kind of good stuff.
My website is maryrobinettekowal.com. Very long. And Twitter is @MaryRobinette. And just for everybody, because this is a pet peeve, Robinette is my middle name. It is not my maiden name. Please do not hyphenate it with Kowal ever.
I did hear you tell someone yesterday that you prefer Mary Robinette.
It is... I grew up in the South, and so... My dad's entire side of the family, because I'm named after my grandmother.
Yes.
And so she was very proud of having a granddaughter named after her. So that entire side of the family calls me Mary Robinette. I'm perfectly fine with Mary. That's what my husband calls me. It's what my parents call me. I gave up on being called Mary Robinette outside of the family years ago. But if you ask me, I will instinctively say Mary Robinette.
Yeah. Well, let's give a round of applause for Mary Robinette. Patrick Hester, and I'm John Emilio, and thank you so much for coming out today.
And we're going to give away some books.
Oh, we'll give away books, but we'll do that off.
Okay.
So I'm going to arm wrestle.
But we're still going to give away books.
We're giving away books,
around.
So hang out. Okay.
So you're going to arm wrestle for the books?
Yeah, no. Okay, who wants...
Gunsmoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
So much proof of Hogan Capricorn.
Oh,
in the company.
Yes.
Speaking as the head of marketing, I am loving it.
Oh. No problem.
And my second is right here.
We had a blast doing it. So we were just thrilled to be invited. And to be honest with you, as cool as everything has been, it's kind of surreal sitting at a table eating a bagel with Gene Wolfe.
Yeah.
It's a good kind of surreal.
Yeah. Right,
yeah.
And you realize as you're talking to him that this means that he can't hear you, and you're supposed to be talking a little bit louder, and then you talk louder, and he's back and fine again.
Yeah.
So,
what about your smooshing lessons?
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.